Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Guarino, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network, helping you live your life to the fullest. How? Real people, including celebrities, real advice, real places, products, and businesses, real life stories. It's all right here for you with this radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. Remember to visit us online, too, at besteveryou.com. And now here's your host, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network, Elizabeth Hamilton Guarino.
Good afternoon, everyone. How is everybody today? And thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening, and thank you so much to Blog Talk Radio for all they do in support of our show. They're on Twitter, at Blog Talk Radio, and we're on Twitter, at Best Ever You. And our guest today is on Twitter at Randi Siegel, ENT. So it's RandiSiegelENT. And you can tweet us live. And, you know, we will ask questions on air to Randi. I know so many people are listening to the show today. It's very exciting to have Randi Siegel with us. And let's go right into Randi Siegel. So I just want to welcome you, and then I'm going to read a little bit about you because there's so much about you. I just want to make sure. Hello.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. It's an honor, a really big honor, and a pleasure to have you with us today. And I know you're kind of a life changer. So I know there's a lot of women who have emailed me saying, "Gosh, how does she do all this stuff she does? Where'd she get her start? How does she write like that? How does she?" So I think there's just so many people really interested in knowing all the ins and outs of all the things that you've done in your life, because it's really cool. You started with you graduated from Denver University with a degree in marketing, and then you started as a receptionist.
Mm-hmm.
And just tell me a little bit about that. How do you go from that to that? I just want to start right there.
Sure.
Go back to your mindset of being in college and going, "You know what, I think I'm going to go be a receptionist here." Why?
Well, of course, that was putting my degree to use. Like, I'm going to answer phones. No, it was one of those things where I went to school actually at UCSB in Santa Barbara for my first year, and I really found that it was nice being in Santa Barbara. It was a little too nice, and I kind of went from being this great, you know, 4.0 student and student body president in high school to kind of not exactly the same thing in college. And I had classes with like 600 people, and it was just not an environment where I really felt like I was doing well. And I transferred to Denver University, which was a small private school. And at the time, I thought I wanted to be in hotel restaurant management. And they were number two in the country. And it was challenging to get in because they actually were tough on my grades from Santa Barbara. They noticed a huge difference. And they said, you know, something happened here. So
by the way, just to interrupt you for one second,
yeah.
I don't know that person at all. I didn't even do that exact same thing.
Gee, I can't imagine.
No drinking.
So yeah, like everybody I'm sure knows exactly. I'm like, I did the same thing.
Yeah.
But they made it really difficult. So I had to spend the spring semester in Santa Barbara really just cracking down, and I had to get my grades up to a certain level. And fortunately I did, and I was able to transfer to Denver, where getting out of state was a great thing, and it was great. And what I found out was I did not want to be in hotel restaurant management, and I ended up with a marketing degree with an emphasis in advertising and consumer behavior for entertainment. And I had done an internship at Entertainment Tonight between my junior and senior years of college, and that was kind of my first taste of the entertainment side, the business side of entertainment. And I liked it. I liked the production side of things. But I really wanted to, I thought, be a lawyer. And I know this is all over the place. But when I left college, I came back to L.A. and I started working at a law firm as a legal assistant. I did not do very well on my LSAT exams. And then I had a whole set of life circumstances change. And which I can brief you on when it makes more sense. But I had a whole set of life circumstances change. I had been listed with a temp agency. They called me up and said, "There's a position. It's a receptionist at an entertainment management company. And we know that it's a receptionist job, but it pays $25 more a week than what you're making. And I was like, I'm in. So I went for the interview. And, you know, just life circumstances, sometimes you have to just do what you have to do. And it turns out it was the greatest thing I ever did, because it turned out to be as a receptionist position for a company called the Brillstein Company, which was run by a man named Bernie Brillstein, who is a legendary talent manager and producer. And he ended up becoming my mentor for my entire career. He passed away 3 years ago. But working there, so I took the job. They offered me the job the same day. And what was funny about it is I did have that mentality of, well, how am I going to go be a receptionist? I have a college degree. I went to a private school. I have four loans. But that was the whole point, was I have four loans, and I have to make the money, and I have to have the job. So it was great, though, because I'm a full believer that if you are going to do any job, you have to know all the jobs that are under that job. And, I mean, if you're going to run a hotel, you have to have, I believe, worked as a busser in the restaurant in that hotel. You have to know what it's about. So people kind of dismiss the idea of being a receptionist, but it's actually the gateway.
Yeah, it's
to everything.
The whole place.
Yeah,
it really is. Yeah, some of the I've done that before too, where I went back to work after my little one went into first grade, and we disguised the title as like vice president of everything and be all and end all of everything, but the job was really picking up the phone. And you became, really, seriously, you became the eyes and ears for the whole place. And it's sort of, I agree with you completely there, that it's just so important to know all the different jobs if you're going to look at you now. I mean, look at all the cool stuff you've done.
Well,
and do you think,
you know, the interesting part about it, too, Elizabeth, is the way that technology is today. I mean, we're talking about 20 years ago I did this.
Yeah.
And 20 years ago, there wasn't direct dial on all the phone systems. There wasn't everything being done by email. I mean, I sat at the front desk of an office where I had kind of a switchboard-type phone, and every call came through me. There was a fax machine behind me. Every fax that came in, I saw and distributed. So I took advantage of the fact that every piece of information had to pass through me, and I learned. But What I learned to do along the way, too, is you have to – I talk to college kids about this a lot, because they're like, well, I'm working in an office, and I know that I can do the job better than the person I'm working for. It's like, no, you don't know that when you're in college. You don't know you can do it
better.
You
think you do.
Exactly. And, you know, I always tell kids that – not even young kids. It's anybody. When you go into a new job in an office, when you start at a new company, when you do anything, you have two ears, two eyes, and one mouth for a reason. You have to look and listen twice as much as you speak. And if you assess the scenario, you assess the relationships, assess the business, then maybe you can start giving some input when you kind of realize who talks to who is in charge of what. Because if you step on the wrong toes from the beginning, you're done.
Uh-huh.
And I've made that mistake.
Well,
I made that mistake time again.
Where did you make that mistake? Because that's so critical, because I remember being like that too. At an internship at a TV station, you know, really walking in it, I might have been all of 17 and thinking, you know, I could run this place, you know, kind of thing. And they quickly put you back in your place of, you know, here's your, you know, you're an intern, be quiet, answer the phone. And yes, you know, maybe at some point we'll put you on camera or do whatever you really want to do or think you're so great at. But for now, go pick up the phone and do a good job at that. But where'd you learn that?
Well, it was trial and error, and, you know, I mean, look, realistically speaking, I still do it.
I know.
Still open my mouth where I shouldn't. But, it's, you know, what are you going to do? So I think the first time, I'll tell you the very first piece of advice I got was actually from John Tesh when he was hosting Entertainment Tonight. That's how long ago this was. And I was an intern, and my direct boss was not the nicest person. He treated interns the way that you hear about Hollywood interns being treated, badly, you know, from scraping gum off someone's shoe to, you know, and it's true. But the way that he spoke to me, I just was like, who does he think he's talking to? And, you know, here I am, 19, being like, rah, rah, rah. And I basically told him when he kind of was mean to me, I said, you know, who do you think you're talking to? You can't talk to me that way. And the whole place, like, got quiet.
I bet.
And the next thing I know, I'm being called in to the, you know, human resources person who runs the intern program. And I had actually, and they said to me, you know, you can't do that. And I had established a relationship with John Tesh from the mornings where my job was to come in early in the morning, like at 7 a.m., and give him his scripts to read for voiceovers that he would record in the sound booth. So I did that a few mornings a week with him, and he was very nice to me. He was always super, super nice. And I walked down to his office after this encounter, and I was really upset, and I told him what happened. And I will never forget it. He sat across the desk from me, and he said, if you want to be in show business, you must develop a thick skin. You have to learn to eat a lot of crow, and you have to learn to like it. If you cannot do that, get out now. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I took it all in, but I did not realize the magnitude of that advice. And I reference it to this day. And it truly was not only the truth, but I think it applies in many businesses, in many environments.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Whenever you're the rookie or whatever, people always, there's a lot of ego out there. But in truth, too, there's a lot of knowledge that if you're really willing, I think, to really listen and learn, there's a lot of things you can learn from people.
And there's not only learn what to do, but you can also learn what not to do.
Not to do, yeah.
And, you know, I had an experience where when I was an assistant at Brillstein Gray, because the company, I was a receptionist there for, I don't know, like 9 months, and then I got promoted. But I didn't get promoted easily. Like, I had to really, like, make it known. I don't want to be here as a receptionist for the next 5 years. So I had to take some initiative and go and talk to the partners. And there was a big change happening later that year where Brad Gray, who now runs Paramount, was a manager at the company, and he partnered with Bernie, and the company became Brillstein Gray. It's now known as Brillstein Entertainment Partners and mm-hmm. still one of the biggest management companies in the business. But when it was switching over, there were all these rumors, you know, people are going to be fired and things are changing. And I figured, okay, well, at least they need someone to answer the phones. So I figured I might be safe there. But by the same time, I was like, come on, this isn't what I bargained for. And, sure. and the interesting part is I had no inclination towards the entertainment business before that. Once I got into the company, once I learned what they did, and what a manager does is just for those people who always wonder, what do managers do? What do agents do? Managers are, in theory and in general, career strategists. It's about managing somebody's career, guiding them for the right choices. Is this the right movie to take? Is this the right TV show to take? If you're a comedian, a manager can help you develop your material, develop your voice, and help turn your material into viable programming. A perfect example, like Jerry Seinfeld or Ray Romano or Tim Allen, their stage act was all based on, like Tim Allen's stage act was based on the Tool Time guy, basically. He was a, you know, guy with tools and power and that whole thing, and it translated into a TV show. So managers are very effective in doing that, especially with comedians. Agents have to be licensed, and their job is to get seek opportunities and get jobs for people. So the whole idea is they get them auditions and, you know, your talent goes in on them, and hopefully you have decisions to make as to what is right and wrong.
That's so interesting. Where do you go? How do you know you're ready for? I'm just curious. How do you know when you're ready for an agent or a manager? Is it just something that just people actually always have?
No.
I'm just curious.
It's hard to get. The reality of it is, there's a ton of people out there who are thinking, it's so hard to get an agent. I can't get an agent. I can't get a manager. And it's true. It's very difficult. And it's difficult because it's so necessary.
It's
that old catch-22 of, like, how do I get auditions if I don't have someone submitting me, and I can't have somebody submitting me if I'm not getting auditions? Because they say, well, what have you done? The agents and managers, it's like there's so many people that need representation, and there's so many people who think that they're great.
Yeah, that's the key right there. There's so many people that think they need it.
It's like, more power to you. You think that you're super funny, but I'm sorry that the booze that you got from the audience the other night didn't tell you that you're not. But you have to give credit to people who are passionate about what they do. And, you know, I think that as if you're a talent and you're seeking representation, you have to put yourself in places where they're going to find you. Because submitting your headshot or calling up or bombarding them with, I need you to be my agent, it's kind of a diminishing returns effect because you're just going to get disappointed and rejected. The better thing to do is find outlets where you're working on your craft. If you're an actor, you should get into an acting class where they provide a showcase at the end of the sessions. And they bring in representation. Because it really is all about not how much you get seen, but does the right person see you?
Yeah.
And that's really what it comes down to. And what I started to learn from being at a company like Brillstein, where their clientele, by the way, was, I would say, 80% comedians and comedy writers, directors, actors. But the core of the business was Saturday Night Live. Adam Sandler, David Spade, Rob Schneider, Fred Wolf, Lorne Michaels, who Bernie had represented for 30 years or whatever. So it was a very, very focused company in the comedy arena. And I started to learn what everybody did. And all I saw, too, was like, oh, everybody's going to comedy clubs and laughing and having a great time. Can I laugh for a living? Because that would be awesome.
Yeah.
So it kind of just rolled itself into that business.
Is that part of why you do what you do? Cause I love our budding friendship because I just think you're one of the most genuine, and I do think you're absolutely funny as all get out people that I know. But you're so well spoken, you're so well written, and you just have a heart about you that's just, it's endless. And that, so I'm loving that about you. And you can hear it in your voice too as you talk and so forth. But is that why you do this? Because you love comedy, or is it because you love people, or what? Why do you do what you do?
Well, it's a combination of things. What it comes down to is, I truly did not choose the comedy business. I believe that it chose me. And I think that for the same way that, like, I represent right now, you know, I represent Frank Stallone, mm-hmm. who's not known as a comedian for sure, but he is
hilarious.
He's unbelievably funny. But his primary career being a musician and a songwriter and a singer, which he's had a phenomenal career, but he talks about as well, music chose him. And I think that when you look at certain people like Frank, who, when he puts a guitar in his hand, it becomes part of his body. It's who he is. My ultimate artist is Prince. Like, I'm a diehard Prince fan.
Mm-hmm.
And, what, you know, some people are like, Prince, right? But you like him or not or whatever about him. But when he plays, it's who he is. There's a lot of great talent like that out there. And in the comedy world, true comedic people, true comedians, true humorists, true performers, they have to do it. There's nothing that they would be able to do otherwise. And when you really learn about the comedy business, it is a very competitive, very dark world, actually. And people on the outside think, oh, my gosh, hanging around with comedians all the time, that must be so fun, and they must always be entertaining and funny. And no.
Yeah.
You could really leave a conversation with a comedian just hanging out and think, I just want to go to sleep.
Yeah, I always wonder that, too, if they're really that funny. I almost think it would be sometimes exhausting to be married to a comedian if they were funny all the time. I'd just be like, oh, man, you need to be serious now for a little bit. You know, I always wondered that, if they're really that funny all the time, because it would be just, oh.
Well, you know, some people just are naturally just funny, you know,
yeah.
Outgoing, funny, witty. And there is a difference. There's a difference between that type of person and comedians who, like, really, it's about material. It's about writing, and they have to get on stage, and they have to say something. And what's interesting about it is I don't know what forces in the universe get to work sometimes for people's lives. And I'm not a religious person. I have trouble with the whole, I believe in spirituality, I guess, to an extent. But what I definitely believe is that there are forces at work sometimes that are way beyond your control. And sometimes an opportunity comes along, and if you don't recognize that that's what it is, you will possibly miss out on something great. But obviously hindsight is 20/20. I mean, look, I ended up as a receptionist for one of the biggest comedy managers and producers in the business, and it became my life because it had to be my life. When I first started realizing that what the company did, who their clients were, these funny people, and I was really drawn to the humor. I was drawn to the talent. And I started to, when I got promoted to be an assistant, I originally worked for a guy who had a lot of film people, like dramatic film actors. Mm-hmm. And then I switched to somebody else's desk, a guy named Ray Rio, who was my first, mentor in that regard. He had Adam Sandler, Rob Schneider, David Spade, on his roster. So those guys were actually writers on SNL at the time.
Right.
They were becoming more and more performers. They were just starting to be on the show with some of these characters that were breaking out. And it was all timing. I ended up working on his desk at a time where these guys were starting to break out. And I was learning the whole process. I got knee-deep in what they were doing. I would start going to the comedy clubs with my boss because Ray would be asked to go out and scout people all the time. People wanted to be represented by him. He was a phenomenal manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, I want to go with you. And he's like, all right. And at some point he was like, you got to stop coming with me.
Yeah, cut it out.
Enough already. But I would go and I would just sit and watch people.
Like being a sponge, probably. You just learn.
Well, you think you know what funny is. You think that you know that somebody's going to be funny. It is. There's a lot of bad comedy out there.
Oh, yeah.
It's not easy. It is one of the hardest things to do. I have the utmost respect for comedians who sit in a room, write something, sometimes in a vacuum. They don't run it by anybody else. They write their stuff, and they get on a stage in front of a room full of strangers who are staring at them, judging them from the minute they walk on stage. And they have a microphone and themselves.
Could
you
do that?
And if it goes badly, huh?
Could you do that? Could you stand up on the stage and with a? I don't know if I could do that, actually.
Well, I do a lot of public speaking.
That actually, I could do.
I've done speaking since I was a kid. Like, I ran for student body president when I was in the sixth grade.
Yeah, and I did that kind of stuff, too. No, that kind of stuff doesn't scare me. That kind of stuff's all right. But, I mean, the actual, like, get up on stage with a microphone and try and think, be funny, or think you're funny, or try and make people, I don't know if I could actually do that.
Well, a lot of people think they can, and they really can't. But the thing is, it is truly one of the most difficult things to do.
Yeah.
And the thing about comedy, and one of the things I love about it so much, it is probably the most subjective form of entertainment that there is. What one person finds hilariously funny, the other person could say, that's terrible. How could you think that's funny? So you rarely find talent or programming even. Talk about TV shows, films, where it is universally accepted as funny. I mean, there's a lot of comedians out there that, are massively successful that some people will say, I don't like them, or I don't like her. I don't think she's funny. And especially female comedians get such a diverse audience of people who love them or hate them.
Oh,
and it's
yeah.
definitely not easy.
Saying what
Bernie,
you really think. That's
got to
be pretty
and
hard.
Bernie Brillstein had a saying that if you haven't been to a comedy club through the kitchen, you're not in the business. And it's a very interesting thought in that you have to know what it smells like, what it feels like, what it sounds like, from the grime to the sweat to the tears. Mm-hmm. And I just found myself loving it. I love being in the club. I love being there till 2 in the morning, hanging out, listening to these people, listening to the comedians, and learning who they were. And I just fell into it, literally fell into it. But I don't think I could live without it, to tell you the truth. I tried to get out of business after 10 years of being in as a manager. I quit. I was out. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I actually wanted to get out of the entertainment business completely. And I was like,
No,
love football.
We're not going to let you do that.
Well, I ended up getting sucked back in. But
yeah,
it truly becomes one of those things where you either love it or you hate it. And if it's in you, it's in you.
Yeah.
And that's just comedy is what I love.
Do you why after 10 years did you do that? What happened that you decided to leave?
Well, during those 10 years, I had a lot of success, and my biggest success story client-wise is Jimmy Fallon,
mm-hmm.
who I was at Brillstein for 5 years, and then I left and went to another company where I was starting a comedy division. A guy who worked at that company knew Jimmy Fallon from upstate New York. His name was Peter. He ran a small town paper. Jimmy was an intern at that paper. Peter shut down the paper to come to LA to start, to get into management for music, actually. So Jimmy was this young kid in college in upstate New York, had a tape of a stand-up set that he did at Bananas in Poughkeepsie when I think he was like 17 years old, gives Peter his tape and says, well, look, if you can ever do anything for me, here's my tape. So cut to me coming to that company to start a comedy division. He says, I have a tape on this kid named Jimmy Fallon. I watched the tape, and I clearly he had talent. I mean, it was basically this kid who was adorable. He had a troll doll in his act, and he did impressions. And that was kind of the act. He did impressions about the troll doll. And music impressions. That's it. That's all he had.
Yeah.
But he was so charming and so good. And I was like, yeah, I'll work with this kid. So that's kind of how it started. And, you know, Jimmy, it turns out I got on the phone with him. And his only dream since the time he was 2 years old was to be on Saturday Night Live. That was it. And I had just been working really closely with the show. I was working very closely with Adam Sandler. I was doing all of his colleges. I had become the script supervisor on 3 of his albums. I was representing one of his writing partners and acting partners, a guy named Alan Covert, who's a phenomenal actor and writer. But so Jimmy was like, well, you know Adam Sandler, so you're going to get me Saturday Night Live. And I was like, well, if that's your qualifier, then okay, let's do this. So
funny.
And it's not easy. I mean, you show me a comedian who doesn't have a dream of being on Saturday Night Live, and I'll give you $5.
Mm-hmm.
But that was how it started. And, you know, he moved to L.A. He quit college. And I said, please, stay in school at least. You have a semester left. And he was like, no, I need to come out there. So he came to L.A., and 6 months after being here, he tested for Saturday Night Live. And it was actually in New York because it was, you know, look, I was tied to the show. I had great relationships there, and Jimmy's super talented. And
he got the
audition to test in New York, and he went on stage. I'll never forget it. He went on stage at the comic strip. They gave him 3 minutes. Everybody had 3 minutes. And
that
was it. It was 3 minutes.
What are you doing 3 minutes?
I know, right? It's you know what? It's not a long period of time, but when you're performing, it could be forever. but that was the year actually that Tracy Morgan auditioned.
Oh, yeah.
And he got the show that year. But what was funny is Jimmy was, I think, 21 or 22 years old. We were standing in the bar area of the club, and in walked Lorne Michaels and his people from the show and Bernie Brillstein and all these people that Jimmy Fallon had only heard about, you know. And Lorne Michaels was his idol. Like, you could say the name Lorne Michaels and Jimmy would, like, his eyes would roll back in his head. Like, that was also a level of pressure, you know.
Oh,
he's
right.
Like, this is my dream. And now you're responsible for it. And I was like, great, okay, let's make that happen. So
no pressure.
He went on stage, and I tell you, he did a great job for what he was capable of doing. His nerves got a little, you know, over him. But the point is, nothing is ever dead in the water, because he got the show 2.5 years later. you know, 2 years later. So he did a great job, but they knew that he had a long way to go. So the next 2 years were spent really focusing on getting the show. He knew he had to work hard. He knew he had to get into classes. And, you know, I worked with him on building toward being prepared at the next time the opportunity came up, because SNL every year would make decisions about the cast. So they test people, or they pick people up in usually July of whatever year it is. So we knew we at least had a year to prep, because then we didn't know what was going to happen, if they were even going to add people the next year. But 2 years spent on classes and working on his stand-up and developing his act. And, you know, what happens is I, as a manager, have to make sure that they're still aware of him. You know, every time he would perform in New York, I would bring people from the show out to see him, or I would keep them apprised on, hey, he just did a role here, or he's doing stand-up at this gig. Because that's what a rep's job is to keep your clients present in the minds of the people who are in charge of giving them jobs. And when the opportunity came, this time it was going to be to test on stage at Saturday Night Live, and he had 8 minutes, and he had to do, you know, characters and impressions. And they said to me, they said, yeah, we don't want to see any troll dolls, though. We already saw the troll doll bit, so now you had to come up with something else. But what's funny is he tells the story all the time, and it's a great story, and I love the fact that he gets interviewed a lot and talks about it. But the side that isn't heard is he lived the performance side of it. And as a rep, you know, you live the nerve side of it, where you do your job the best that you can do, and then it's up to your client to go in and either knock it out of the park or not. And that's what's hard, is because you have no control once you turn it over to that. And, you know, I really worked hard for those 2 years to make sure that opportunity was met, you know, as best prepared as he could be. And he had the goods. That was the thing. And I believed in him. There were times during those 2 years, agents turned their backs on him. People didn't want to book him sometimes, because the ebbs and flows of the business, it is very, very fickle. It's a very fickle business.
What a really neat story, because from just an average viewer perspective, we don't know all that. We just think, oh, Jimmy Fallon, he was born funny, and he is funny, and everything was handed to him, and, you know, he's got his own show, and he's got this and got that. And from our point of view, not knowing anything about him, really, or really probably anybody too in depth, unless you're really reading up on them and memorizing them and so forth. Like, I'd never heard any of that before about Jimmy Fallon. And from my point of view, I would have thought it would just be a complete easy street, because he's just so darn hilarious. So it's really interesting to hear, and I think it's a really good point, because a lot of people follow Best Ever You because they're in that mode of, I want to be a writer, or I want to be a musician, or I want to, you know, they want to be something in the arts or entertainment business. We have a ton of people like that, and they feel like giving up, quite frankly. A lot of people, they can't get an agent, they can't get this, they can't get their book seen, they can't, you know, and people want to give up, and here's a really good example of not.
Well, it is challenging. As talent, it's definitely difficult, because when you get rejected more often than you get accepted, it is really hard to say, I'm going to get up and do it again. Like, who does that? You know, it's like, I just smashed my hand with a hammer. You know what? I'm going to do it again.
Yeah.
I didn't break enough fingers. It's fascinating to me. And I have a lot of respect for talent, because it takes so much. I don't know, actually, what is in them sometimes that makes them do this over and over. But the flip side to that is on the representation side, and I guess that this could kind of apply to any job or anyone's life who has a circle of people around them. If you do not have a champion, it is very hard to look in the mirror and just tell yourself that you're good enough and that you can do it. It's like that Stuart Smalley bit from Saturday Night Live. I'm good enough. I'm strong enough, and doggone it, people like me. You know, what's funny about that is comedy comes from tragedy. And that sketch kind of is this reflection of the true nature of what people struggle with, that you must believe in yourself. If you do not believe in yourself, it is very hard to get someone else to believe in you. However, that said, it is when you doubt yourself, it is when you're not sure, that that one voice, one little voice that says to you, I think you've got it. I think you can do it. You've just lost your way. It changes everything.
Everything.
And I've never experienced it more than being a manager of all comedians, by the way, who are insanely complicated people, to say to somebody who is doubting themselves, who doesn't believe that they can do it, they're very insecure, that you believe in what they can be. But then, why would they listen to me? What makes me somebody who says, you know, yeah, I can help you become that? Why are they going to listen to me? And that's the hard part of it, too, in the entertainment business. And when talent has to turn themselves over to representation and trust those people, it could be tragic consequences because there's a lot of shady people in the business, or it could be insanely successful. And, you know, Frank Stallone, who I've been working with for going on 7 months, we met about a year ago. It took us 6 months to get to the point of working together. He's somebody who, over the years, has had so many bad experiences, has had so many agents or managers just love having the name Stallone to talk about, but didn't really get on board with him. And when he and I decided to work together, he put a lot of faith in me. And I have made it a point over the years that if I was going to be in this business, if I was going to work with people and have people try to trust me, I had to come through. And, you know, look, maybe there's places I could have gotten further along over the years of my career by doing something shady or selling somebody out or sleeping my way somewhere.
No, that's what we love about you. That's what I sense about you, is you're just a complete integrity. That's my favorite thing about you, totally.
Or at least letting you believe that. No, the reality of it is you go through stages of things in your life. You do question, am I doing this the right way? And I had a phenomenal mentor. Bernie Brillstein was my guiding source. And he had a philosophy of you never lie to your clients. You have to be the one that they can turn to. And if they leave you because of that, they're leaving you because you were honest. And that's not on you.
Yep.
You know? And it becomes one of these things where I wanted to work hard for these people because I believed in them. And someone like Jimmy Fallon, who was this kid from upstate New York, comes to Los Angeles with no act. I mean, he really,
I can't even imagine that. Just seeing him on TV now, you're like, really?
Yeah. And the interesting part about it was,
that's so cool.
At first, you know, I was this young manager going, I've got this next hot kid. And people were like, yeah, sure you do. But then he kind of popped. And everyone started to really see, holy cow, this kid's got something. But there were a lot of people that weren't on his side. There were a lot of agents that were like, yeah, well, he has nothing going on, so why do I want to work with him? But he had his first agents at APA. They believed in him. And we went through a lot where people turn their backs on him sometimes. But as a manager, and I ended up on my own, that company that I went to, it was kind of like a bad marriage. I left. I ended up on my own, and my clients came with me, and I worked out of my apartment, and I'm trying to get Jimmy Fallon on Saturday Night Live. Everybody is telling him it's never going to happen because he was with me working on my own.
Oh,
and that's what's
God.
Interesting. I went from being at one of the biggest management companies in the business. So everybody's calling me, and my call sheet was long, and people are returning my calls.
Sure.
And then I go to another company where, all right, you know, my call sheet shrunk a little. Maybe my calls weren't being returned as quickly, you know. And then when I ended up on my own, oh, please, people turned their backs on me. You know, there was a very short list of people who still cared and supported me and took my calls no matter what. Mm-hmm. And, look, on one hand, that's just the nature of the business. If you're no longer in a certain position, people don't need to deal with you. So that's the nature of the beast. However, there are some people who still step up and make the phone call to say, how are you doing? What's going on? How can I help you? And that's what's important to remember, is that everybody needs to hear that phone call sometimes. Mm-hmm. Just because somebody is out of a job, just because somebody is down and out, just because somebody isn't at the top of their game in that moment, does not mean it's not going to change.
Amen.
And when I spent 2 years...
Whatever word we want to use.
I know, right? Yeah. Hallelujah!
Hallelujah!
When I spent 2 years driving videotapes around of my clients to drop them off at casting offices because I couldn't afford messengers, when I... you know, kept calling and saying, look, I'm telling you, Jimmy's going to make it. He's going to be on SNL. We're going to make this happen. And he would be out in the clubs, and big-time managers and agents would talk to him and say, you know, if you really need to get on the show, you got to be, you're never going to make
with
it with her.
Or whatever. Oh, boy.
And he said, I'm going to stay with her.
Good for him.
And, you know, 2 years after he first tested for it, he got the show. And what's interesting about it is, you do your best. You send your kids off to school, and you hope that they take every lesson that you've ever taught them with them, I guess. I'm not a parent, but that's what it's like. Yeah. And when he went to New York to test for the show that second time, I was in L.A., you know, just completely. It's amazing I didn't become an alcoholic in those few days because you
sound like, you know, I don't drink, but sometimes.
I mean, I'm one now, but I didn't become one then. No, but he goes to do the show. He called me from the hotel and said, all right, I'm going to go over there. I'm like, all right. And, you know, you figure it's going to take a certain amount of time. Like 4 hours go by, I don't hear from him.
Oh, no.
I'm like, geez, what is going on? And then finally, he calls me, I don't know, it might have been 5 hours later. And I'm like, oh, my God, Jimmy Fallon, how did it go? And this is the answer I get. Well, I think it went okay.
Oh,
I was like, oh, you got to be joking. This is what I get? After 5 hours, this is what I get?
Well, I think it's going to be okay.
I said, what do you mean you think it went okay? And then he tells me this story about how he went out there. And, you know, you have to establish goals. Before he went this time, you realize, look, do not go there with the goal to get the show. Go there with a more attainable goal. And whenever people audition for roles, I always say to them, don't go in the room thinking this is to get the job. Go in there just to make sure that the casting people or the producers, whoever it is, just that they like you. You want them to just like you enough to want to see you again. Maybe it's not for this. Maybe it's not going to be tomorrow. But you just want them to like you. And that's a much more attainable goal. It's much more reasonable. And it's not as easy as it sounds, by the way. So Jimmy decided that his goal was that he wanted to make Lorne Michaels laugh. And when he tells the story, it's exactly what happened. You get told as a talent, they're going to be sitting there in the seats right in front on the stage, you know, in front of the stage. Lorne does not laugh, but you can't let that throw you. You have to plow through. Because, you know, you got to think about it. You're on stage. Your job is to make the room laugh, and they're giving you nothing. I mean, that's psychologically, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I'd be done.
But, you know, so talk about trying to overcome something. Yeah. But it's like you go on that stage, and it gets satellited to Burbank. It's a big deal. So his goal was, I just want to make Lorne laugh. And I was like, great, that's great. And I thought to myself, at least his mindset is there. And we had worked on his audition the night before. So he says, I think I did okay. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, I started to do, you know, my bit, and about the third impression in, when I was doing Adam Sandler, Lorne Michaels laughed. And he was, like, he was so excited. And he says, and then I blacked out. He's like, I don't remember anything after that. I'm like, what are you talking about? You don't remember. So he says, well, after I got done, Marcy and Ayala, those are the two people. But Marcy Klein, who is a phenomenal producer and back then was producing for SNL and was head of talent. She now produces 30 Rock, and she's amazing. And another girl named Ayala Cohen, who was also one of the heads of talent. She's now an agent. But these were my two people. These are the people, by the way, that I had been in the trenches with for years, that I worked with, you know, Sandler and Spade and all those guys. And so he says, well, they came into the dressing room afterwards, and they said to me, they said, do you realize how well you just did? I'm like, well, don't you think that that's an indicator? How can you tell me that you don't know how you did? So all I know is I'm not getting a straight answer from my client. I don't know what happened. And he had to be on a plane first thing in the morning because he was actually in the middle of shooting an independent film. And he had to get back on the set the next day. They were very kind and adjusted their schedule for him to go test for SNL. So I was like, all right, look, you got to get on a plane in the morning. I'm picking you up at noon at the airport. I'll see you there. Godspeed, you know? So I'm nervous now. And the whole night, I'm wondering what happened. Well, I get a phone call from my old boss, Ray Rio, who was working with Fred Wolf, who was a writer on SNL. And he says, oh, Fred called me to tell me that Jimmy did great. I mean, this took a village. You got to understand, over the years, you get people on board to like it. It's a campaign, actually. It is not that easy to get a show like that.
I get it now. Yeah, I don't know. I think we all think they're just born into it or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, there's a lot more than
there's a lot of
guys.
Moving parts,
yeah.
You know, between agents and managers. And they do a lot of work for this, you know. And ultimately, though, it is the talent's job. And if you've got a talented client, their talent will rise no matter what.
Yeah.
So in the morning, my phone rang at 5 in the morning, and it was Ayala and Marcy because it was 8 o'clock in New York. And they called me up, and I'm like, what happened? What are you calling to tell me? And they're like, well, we're calling to tell you how great he did. And I'm just sitting there, like, sweating, you know? Because this was a lot of, you know, hope and dreams on this one moment that he had. So they said, I mean, he's getting the show. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. They're like, no. They're like, he did phenomenal. And they were saying, like, how just great the audition was. And it was so exciting to hear that the hard work, the input, and really the energy was paying off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, look, here's the deal, though. You can't tell him that he's got the show. This was, I think, by the way, a Wednesday morning. You can't tell him because Lorne wants to meet with him in L.A., and he wants to be the one to tell him himself.
Oh.
I'm like, all right, so what am I supposed to tell him? You know, how am I supposed to sit on this information? This is the biggest news of this kid's life, and I got to sit on it?
You got to sit on it.
So they were like, just, you could tell him that he did really, really well. And I'm like, oh, geez, this is going to be hard.
Great.
Because now I deserve an Academy Award for the acting job I'm going to have to do.
I was going
to
say, can people tell from your, I mean, can you keep a secret like that? Like, or can people really tell? See, my facial expression would give that away. Like,
you know,
I don't think I could do that.
When you know that there's so many moving parts involved that you don't want to screw up, you do what you have to do, you know?
Yeah.
And the best part is, I mean, now I had to wait till noon, though, to even see Jimmy. And it's 5 in the morning. They and no one's up at 5. Who am I going to call, you know?
Yeah.
So I started drinking. And no, I'm kidding. I went to pick him up at the airport, and I get him, and I say, so we're sitting at baggage claim. And I get and I go, God, I go, yeah, I'm really tired. How about you? And he goes, yeah, I'm tired. He's like, I'm just kind of, you know, nervous about how I did. And I go, oh, well, I'm tired because someone called me at 5 this morning. He's like, what? Who called you at 5 in the morning? What kind of rude friends do you have? And I said to myself, well, it was Ayala and Marcy. And he goes, oh, my God, what happened? So I said, look, here's what I can tell you. You did really, really well. And Lauren wants to meet with you on Friday in his office. And he turned white. He, like, almost passed out in baggage claim. So I'm like, okay, look, this is all good news. You know, we're just going to keep moving forward. We'll see what happens. So I get him back to the set, and then later that day, Adam Sandler called me. And Sandler says, hey, I just want to congratulate you on Jimmy getting the show. I go, no, nothing's official yet. And he's like, you know he's getting the show. And I was like, come on, you can't put the pressure. And he says, they played Jimmy's audition for Adam over the phone, and he heard the impression. He goes, it's just great, and, you know, congratulations. So now I'm sitting on the information that Adam Sandler called to say congrats. So I'm a mess for the week. Jimmy goes to meet with Lauren on the Friday. Sure enough, that takes 6 hours, and I'm sitting there biting my nails again. He calls me from Paramount, from a payphone at Paramount, and says, Lorne Michaels just told me I got Saturday Night Live. And he was just over the moon. So now it's all official. And then he said, I say, all right, why don't we go to dinner? Let's go to dinner. Let's celebrate. And he says, okay, but it has to be someplace really cool. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he says, well, when I tell the story that Lorne Michaels told me I got Saturday Night Live, and then my manager took me to dinner at blank, it has to fit. So I was like, oh, this is hilarious. So we ended up going to Spago, you know, and yeah. At the time it was like the Spago that was like the big hoopla Spago. So we go, and one of his friends came with, and we get, when Jimmy and I got there, we go to the bar and we ordered Manhattans, of course, because now he's going to be in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever had a Manhattan, but you may as well drink some gasoline.
Oh.
And that would be the same thing.
Same thing as a Manhattan.
So we were like, this is disgusting, but we're drinking it down.
Kamikazes in college. I don't know if that's the equivalent of a Manhattan, but whatever.
You know what? Kamikazes were the bomb compared to Manhattans. Oh. So we get, his friend tells the waitress, oh, we're celebrating something for him. So they bring a little cake with a candle and a plate that says congratulations. And he blows out the candle, you know. And then he's like really, really, really super quiet. I'm like, well, what's going on? What are you thinking? And then he says, you know, since I can remember, as young as I can remember, when I started blowing out candles, I used to wish for Saturday Night Live.
Aww.
This was the first time I didn't know what to wish for.
And
I lost it. I mean, I lose it now. It was such an incredible moment.
Oh,
and,
nice, too. I love the fact that he's not all ego. He's nice. Oh.
Well, that moment is what I think anybody kind of, like, lives for, is you work hard to achieve something. And when something like that happens, and by the way, I was still working on my own. I had not joined a company yet.
Mm-mm.
I was still working as Randy Siegel Entertainment, you know, working hard, and he got the show. And in that moment, you kind of say, how does something like this even happen? Because it could have gone the other way. And then what do you do?
Yeah.
So it was one of those things where not only does the business just kind of consume me, but I think about it where being a part of something like that and having somebody's dream be realized, where I got to the point, and I know this is a long journey back to your original question about why did I get out of it, having had something like that happen, and then, you know, through many years with him at SNL and movies and stuff like that, I got to a point where it was all about everybody else's dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I started developing my comedic instincts as a producer. And I was becoming more creative on projects, and I got more involved with, you know, scripts and script development. And I was starting to have more of a creative mind of my own. But as a rep, sometimes you have limitations to what you can do for your own career. So I got to a point where I was kind of like married to 8 guys. I had most, you know, my clients were all guys. And it was really my life belonged to them. I had no life of my own. And I got to that point where it was just, oh, what am I doing? And I saw my future 10 years from then. And I was like, oh, if 10 years from now I'm still telling my client, oh, yeah, I think you should go with the red shoes. And, well, you should tell that girl that you really don't want to date her anymore. And you're paging me why.
Beyond which show to, it does. It goes into their personal lives, too.
Yes.
I'm sure, yeah, because you become a complete friend in all areas. So it's not just as simple as let's go try out for this or that.
No.
Much
no.
more.
It's all encompassing. It's all encompassing. I can't tell you how many times I had to kick girls out of guys' beds, bail them out of jail, take them to rehab.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. But, you know, the stuff like that that makes you kind of say what do I ultimately want to do?
What do you want to do, yeah.
And you have to figure that out at some point in your life, you know, because you're only going to get older. And it's only going to
No, we are
more.
Not. No, we're not. We're getting wiser.
Right.
Yeah.
You keep telling that to yourself, Elizabeth. But you do, and you have to also make decisions along the way as to how you're going to proceed with your own career and build a reputation for yourself, too. And being, you know, I went through a lot. Being a female in the comedy business is not easy. It's very challenging. Very challenging. You have to put up with a lot. And you have to have a thick skin. And you have to not get offended easily. Comedy is nasty sometimes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I said, you know, I always, that's, I want to interrupt for 1 second here and just let everybody know. We have 5 minutes left on this call, and we've probably got a whole other hour's worth of information. So we're going to keep going. What's going to happen, though, is the show is going to cut off for everybody listening live. And then when we're done with the show, it'll go up into replay mode, and you can just click on the show to listen to the rest of the show. Because we're going to keep, is that okay with you, Randy, if we keep going? On the note of, comedy, I mean, if I always worry, like, if I said half the, my husband thinks I've, like, some, there's a 13-year-old comedic boy in me half the time or something, you know, cause half the stuff I say is just so goofy and whatever, and probably comes from having four boys, but he's like, you cannot say that. Don't post that. Don't do that. Don't, do, you know, that kind of stuff. So he's always kind of capping half the stuff I think or say. But it's like that in comedy, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, there's a lot of F words thrown around and a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of stuff that people think and it comes blurting out.
Yeah, I mean, not only just comedy itself, which is its own isolated, you know, focus in entertainment, but the entertainment business is a very loosely structured business sometimes. You know, production is a very, you know, nitty-gritty grind of a business. You know, you're out there, you know, working sometimes, you know, on night shoots and working in the trenches where there's a lot that goes on, and sometimes you can't take things personally, you know, and foul language is foul language, you know.
Sure.
Not everybody is going to be PC, and I had never experienced a corporate, stiff corporate drone life like I did when I went to work at MySpace. I had never been in a large corporation before. MySpace was owned by News Corp, which is a Fox company. And I went for the first time into this environment that had cubicles, that had human resources.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was used to being in companies with like maybe 20, 30 people, if that, where everyone was a creative brain. And someone could say to you, you know what, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. And you didn't take that personally.
Oh, yeah. Not at something. Yeah. See, I come from the corporate world, and I think I'm progressively trying to get the corporate world out of me because it's that exactly. You can't even swear in a corporate environment, or you're going to end up in HR, or, you know, God forbid the F word comes out of you because you'll be done, you know.
Yeah.
Kind
and
of
you
thing.
Know, I find Maybe. That fascinating because there's just certain things that, and look, I'm not saying that every corporate environment should be like, hey, just let the curse words fly. No, I mean, you know what I mean? You have to be respectable and not have a foul mouth, you know? Sometimes I can go off on really bad tangents of stuff, but
sure.
The thing about it is, as any environment dictates, there's a certain amount of respect that should just go between people.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that respect should also be that you can't take everything personally.
Personally, yes.
The sensitivity factor, I think, is way too high sometimes.
Yeah.
And when you find yourself in that environment, what are you supposed to do about it? Well, you can either try and fight the system and, you know, be like, well, I'm going to do what I want. You'll find yourself out the door.
Yeah.
You will probably find yourself out the door. Or you can figure out a way to make it work for you. And there are adjustments. I mean, when I went to MySpace, I could not believe how quiet and corporate everything was.
I would have never
thought that. It's supposed to be a creative zone.
I thought that was in California and was like a startup kind of thing. I would think MySpace would have been like free and clear of everything, kind of loosey-goosey, because it's music and, you know, comedy, which you're responsible for and things like that. So, that's interesting.
That must have been
a really interesting fit for you.
Well, yeah, and mind you, a year later I got laid off. So that
whatever, yeah.
But the thing, fortunately, it wasn't because I fucked the system. But the thing that was interesting is I went into this environment where I was a comedy person. I was supposed to be bringing comedy. And I sat in my office. They were building out some office space, so I wasn't in an office yet because it was being built. So I was at one of the cubicle desks. And I had actually never done that.
Did you hang up pictures?
I did. I decorated, of course. I actually love my stuff. I have to have stuff. Like, I have gadgets.
Oh, yeah.
Like, things that make noise. That's just how I operate. So that's not, though, how everybody else operated. And I'll never forget that one morning I was listening to some comedy piece on my computer. It was early, and not a lot of people were in yet, and I was listening to it. I wasn't listening to it loud. And it was some stand-up comedy thing, and somebody popped their head over the cubicle and goes, could you turn that down, please? It's a little annoying.
Oh, wow.
And I thought to myself, what has happened here?
And you need a gadget. You just need one of those things that comes up.
I'm sorry. Comedy is annoying? I'm sorry, what? But I was shocked. So I had a very big culture shock going into that company.
Oh, I bet.
And I think that when they finished the offices, they put me at the very end because they were like, let's stick Randy way down there. And it was one of those challenges where I went to MySpace after I had been, well, 9 years prior is when I had left management, but I had spent 5 years as the head of talent and development at National Lampoon, which was a very different environment. National Lampoon was hugely creative environment, a very tight-knit group of people. It was a pretty crazy place to work, actually, and where you could get into it with your creative partners. You know, the head of the editor-in-chief of the Lampoon, his name was Scott Rubin, and I actually ended up hiring him to be my editor at MySpace, one of the most brilliant comedy minds, phenomenal writer. And we used to just go at it with the arguing about creative, and you get into the fights, and that's not funny, and maybe you should learn how to get what comedy is. And people would be like, oh, that's just Randy and Scott. When that happened, by the way, when we were at MySpace, this is no joke, I am not kidding you, somebody complained. And my boss came to me and said, there was a complaint about how you and Scott talk to each other. And I thought
Wait, they're not even in the conversation. They're complaining about how you guys talk to each other.
Correct.
Oh, that's funny. That sounds corporate, very corporate.
I couldn't believe it.
The whole time you're talking about MySpace and cubicles and everything, I'm going back. I was pregnant twice in a corporate environment, in a cubicle kind of thing. And I'm just thinking back to the whole thing. You've brought back cubicle memories. It's like, oh, man, those were gone. It's funny. But, yeah, isn't that just wild?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. But you know what's interesting is what I've learned over the years, and what I do a lot of speaking about, and I, you know, do, like, consulting for corporate environments for how to allow humor in the workplace. You know, because there's a lot of people who have a good sense of humor. They're just stifled. You know, and there are people who don't know how to implement their sense of humor. You know, and just because it's a corporate environment or just because it's very PC doesn't mean that you can't have lighter moments. It doesn't mean that you have to sit in a room or in a meeting and be like a robot. And that's what I found was happening when I went there. And I was somebody who spoke out or would say something funny or would throw out a comment that was, for some people, just like, oh, how could she say something like that? But I think that when you find yourself working for people or with people that actually enjoy the fact that somebody is trying to do something different and they give you the room to do that is when it works well. I actually had a great set of bosses. My direct report was really a good boss in that he let me go toe-to-toe with him on things. Mm-hmm. But over the years, I've also learned how to go toe-to-toe with somebody. You have to know where your moments are. You have to pick your opportunities, and you have to know your limitations in those opportunities. But when you do get that opportunity, or if you get that opportunity, if you do not use it wisely, you won't get it again. And if you go the wrong direction with it, somebody won't trust your instincts again.
Right.
And when I went to MySpace, you know, I was supposed to be doing original comedy content that MySpace had never done. So,
which you did, by the way, and I'm wondering how you did it because.
Well, the piece that I sent you a link that Stony Awards.
Get away with that. But tell me what it was called again. I interrupted. Sorry.
The Stony Awards.
Yeah, the Stony Awards. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did we do that? Because I'm thinking the whole time I was watching that, going, I wonder what would happen if I posted this in my Facebook.
Well, you know what? It's a great piece. See, that's the thing. It's not about weed. High Times magazine does this awards every year called the Stony Awards, and they actually give awards to film and television for the use of weed,
yeah,
or the highest moments in TV or whatever.
Hilarious.
From a comedic standpoint, I mean, come on, the humor's
oh,
built
yeah.
in. The
it's
fact
endless.
That they have awards for this, that's the first thing.
The
second
yeah.
thing is I wanted to cover it like a serious event, you know?
Oh.
So I went to my boss, and I said, I want to cover the Stony Awards. He says, no, we can't do anything with pot. And I go, have you looked at MySpace lately? Do you know who's on it? I mean, let's start there. That's second of all, it's not about pot. It's comedy.
It's about
taking on
words.
This world. And again, he was resistant because he said they're never going to go for it. Okay, because
who's they?
The corporate they.
Okay. The corporate
yeah.
day, yeah.
The corporate they.
That's what you're saying. I'm like, people
yeah.
will love it. It's the they that are questionable.
Right. And of course, the corporate they includes the subcategory legal department.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Who's going to sue who and why?
Yeah.
And, well, who have we offended? And oh, boy.
Exactly. The online community for entertainment is so vast now. You have to make an impact. You have to push the envelope. Quality content will always win out. Always.
Mm-hmm.
No matter whether you get 100,000 views on something or 20,000 views on something, if it is good, it will survive.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what it comes down to.
Or if it's flat out ridiculously like 10-year-old humor. Like my kids are all on there going, oh, you see the kid who just got back from the dentist with the, you know, it's like, to me, I'm like, that's just not even remotely funny. But to them, it's absolutely hysterical. See, now if I were in management there, I was or were or whatever, they're looking at your resume, I would just be like, oh, okay, well, Jimmy Fallon, check. Okay, what do you want to do?
You know, there is a certain element to that makes sense, yes. Because it's like, okay, you've proven that you can do something.
Like, here, let me write your check. What do you want
to
do? Here.
To an extent, yes. You're right.
Yeah.
And anyone's track record is their calling card. And it is what gets you to get trusted or have somebody say, you know what, you've done it before, you could probably do it again. There's a lot of people, though, that go, yeah, you got lucky.
Oh, geez.
Okay? So, which is fine.
That would freak me. I'd have to freak out on somebody for saying that to me. I'd be like, no.
But see, that's the thing is it depends on how you process it.
Yeah.
Nobody else lived in my shoes. And do I have a shelf full of Emmys? Do I have a record of television series that have had, you know, 50 episodes on the air? No, I don't. Do I wish I did? Of course I wish I did. I wish I had a couple of Emmys sitting on my shelf.
You know, you're still young. I think you've got a whole huge future ahead of you.
Comparatively, I'm not.
No, the entertainment business does that to people, though, where the entertainment business seems to like be like, oh, you're 30 or 40, up next, you know, kind of thing. But, you know, it's all in where you are.
So
you know what I mean?
Here's what's interesting, I believe me, I appreciate that you said I'm young.
Oh, yeah, you
but
are. You got a whole life
I'm
ahead
not.
Of you.
I'm not. I'll tell you this much. I've never experienced ageism the way that I've experienced it in the last few years.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Before I got the job at MySpace, I had worked for a guy named Fred Silverman, who is a legend. He's the only man who ever ran programming at all three of the major networks. The man changed programming forever. And I got to work with him for a year on his production company. But after a year, he also wanted to shut it. He was kind of done. He was like, I'm 70. I don't want to do this anymore. And when I found myself interviewing again for jobs, I could not really believe how in my face the ageism thing was.
Yeah,
because
that is.
At that point, I've been around. But I would watch people calculate. So let's see. So if you represented Jimmy Fallon when you were 27 or 28 and he got SNL, and literally they do the math in front
of
me.
The math? Really?
They do. I saw somebody, like it was like lining up the sevens on a jackpot machine where they realized, oh, geez,
or something.
Because I was older than people that were interviewing me. So
well,
like,
yeah. But, I mean, in the big scheme, I mean more of like in the big world, you're still really young. I mean, a lot of things happen to people in their 40s, 50s, 60s. You know, there's if you want it to, there's still a ton of life ahead of you to do amazing things in the world. I mean, I wouldn't let anybody tell me I'm old, young, or otherwise for anything.
Well, unfortunately,
but
I
hear
you can have that mentality. And, yes, it's the right mentality to have. And I say, you know what, call me old, call me whatever. But when you are not the person who's in control of a situation,
yeah,
it is what it is. Either somebody's going to hire you or they're not.
Or they're not.
You can't force them to.
It just happened to my husband in droves over the past year looking for a new job. And he's 55. And people kept using the word senior. You're too senior. You're too senior. You're too senior. And it's a polite way of saying you're too old, too old, too old kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, I get it. We've experienced it here. But
yeah, so it doesn't make things any easier.
Easier,
and when,
no.
When I go into a company, you know, when I went into a company like MySpace, look, they hired me. I did not know anything about social media, knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were okay with that because they needed me for what I did know, comedy, production, budgets, talent, all of that stuff. And I'm someone who loves to learn. I went in there and wanted to sit down with the tech people and learn how they built the site. And they were like, why are you here?
That's how I learned, too. I have to. I'm really strange like that. Like, I really have to know everything. I kind of do that when I used to work for a company. I'm like, no, I almost need to sit down in the board meeting so I understand what's really going on at the company at a high level so that I can function down here even. So I know what to get, you know what I mean? I'm just, I just have to do that. I have to know everything about the whole entire company.
Well, it helps you be more efficient.
Properly. Yeah, different.
You could do something at a high level that helps that person.
Yep.
Who's in another job and in the same, you know, wheelhouse where
that connector. Yeah.
If you don't know what they have to do, you could make their job 10 times harder. When I went to MySpace and was very open to the whole social media education, which now, you know, is just part of what I do, but this whole thing of I came here to make a difference for you guys, and I'm not going to do anything to screw that up. I have the best interest of the company in mind.
And yourself and everybody around you and the talent. And, I mean, it's a whole big picture of everybody's best interest
that is
at
true.
Heart, too.
That is
you know.
True. And, you know, I work with this young director. His name is Dustin Gould, who has a phenomenal eye for comedy. And, you know, he knows exactly what needs to get done with stuff like this. And we did this shoot. We went and we covered the Stony Awards. I had to run it by legal. They had to look at it. And the PR team had to look at it. And I'm sitting there shaking in my shoes. I was just sweating bullets.
Did anybody crack a smile or laugh, or were they all?
Here's what's so funny. They sat there trying to actively not laugh.
Laugh, yeah.
Because they're so used to this corporate, God forbid you laugh at something that might be slightly off color. And there was nothing off color about the piece. The piece is hilarious, you know, about the Stony Awards. But and my reporter ends up getting stoned.
If I laugh at this, are people going to think I smoke pot too? Or if I, you know, there's a whole thing there that goes on in the corporate head or anybody's head, probably in a way. If you're going to endorse something and put it on there or laugh at it or pass it around or whatever, people are going to, you know, it's like if people are going to pass judgment.
The legal team had nothing to keep me from doing it. They were concerned, highly concerned, though, about the subject matter. And then the PR team didn't even want to get behind it.
Mm-mm.
So Scott Rubin, you know, who is my editor-in-chief, he decided, you know, to really pound the pavement on pushing it out because we didn't get support from the PR team and really put forth the effort to get it out. And sure enough, it started to pick up some steam. And Business Insider did an article about it, and the headline was, "This is the best thing we've seen from MySpace ever."
Oh, my God.
And that kicked in the Huffington Post and another, and the company originally was still against it, yet this is now exactly what you want from something that you put out there. And then ultimately when the company sold and my department was obliterated anyway, I was disappointed because I learned all about social media. You know, one of the guys that I worked with there, he was the head of social, was a guy named Sean Percival, who is just this social media internet genius, and really was kind to me. Like, we would sit in meetings where I had no idea what they were saying. No idea. The technology terms, the verbiage.
I know those meetings.
I had no idea what some of the acronyms were. And then they would look at me and they'd be like, so Randy, you'll handle that for the comedy department? And I would be like, sure, absolutely. And then I would walk out and be like, Sean? And he'd be like, so let's sit down and talk.
Oh, funny.
Because I had no idea what I was doing at first. But the fact that I was willing to learn was key. And I think that's the thing with anyone who goes into a job or a job interview or meets with somebody about a job, you cannot oversell yourself. And you cannot lie about what you know or don't know. Because A, it's just wrong. But B, it will come out.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You cannot play catch up.
Be full of crap at all. Definitely. Yeah. You know, it's interesting too. I did this interview with Robin Mead from HLN News.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably almost, I want to go 2 years ago now. And this kind of goes back to what you were saying about being a receptionist and being an intern, and just all the way back to the beginning of our conversation. She said, you know, they get oodles of people that are interns there, right? And people fight for being an intern there. And then once they get there, she said, a lot of the interns, she said like almost 95% of them spend their entire internship working on their resume to leave HLN to go do something else. Whereas if they would just focus in on what they were doing and be appreciative and learn, they'd probably have a job there.
Right. That's true. Sometimes it's right underneath your nose.
Yeah, and you just don't see it or anything. But she was talking about how important that is and how important it is to work your way up and to and she was talking about never lying and things like that. She suffers from really, I don't know if she suffers from it anymore, but really bad anxiety attacks, like on-air actual anxiety attacks.
Hmm.
And so she was just a really neat person, but she talked a lot about how she worked her way up, and she did it through just being full of integrity and full of loving what she did. And just she's got kind of a background in news, kind of similar to you have in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Just how she started and things like that. So it's pretty interesting how people do things. And would you, if you weren't doing what you did, are doing right now,
mm-hmm.
what do you think you would be doing?
That's a really good question. You know, I kind of think about that every day. Because every day I'm reminded I'm back in management now, and every day I'm reminded as to why I left management.
That's funny.
A lot of my world right now is about the Frank Stallone career. But what's different about it now is it's also my career because I'm a creative partner with him. I was not willing to give that up. There's just no way. So projects that we're developing together, I'm very invested in. You know, and he actually loves the fact that I bring ideas to the table and can make a difference with how we're trying to move forward with stuff and being creative in regard to rebuilding somebody who has been kind of overlooked for years. But if I wasn't doing this, I think that I would be working with talent somehow because I love working with talent. And I would be doing what I'd probably have been doing for the last 10 years, producing content. My goal was to get a job. After MySpace, I was looking for another job in either a digital company or at a network. I love television. Not that I don't love film, but I love TV. I love the internet. You know, I've gotten more into the speaking game, talking to college kids. I'm an adjunct professor for Boston University. I'm going to be teaching again in the spring semester. I have a class every year. They come out to LA for a semester and take classes with industry executives and learn all about either law or production, and my class is the world of representation, agents, managers, publicists, the whole thing, career strategies, contract negotiations. So I love doing that, and I love consulting for comedians on material, and I love, you know, speaking, and I do a lot of it, and I'm looking to do a lot more of it. You know, I have these seminars that I've put together for corporate environments of, you know, how to deal with humor in the workplace and pitching
there's
projects.
A good one. That's a good,
yeah,
that's probably, that's probably a genius seminar that would go everywhere. I think that's brilliant right there.
Well, I tell you, there's some people who don't fit a corporate mold, or there's some people who have a hard time fitting it, or there's some people who just need to loosen up, for God's sake. It's like, oh, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
A joke is a joke.
Oh, I've been in trouble so many times, I just don't even want to think about it.
It's amazing.
I think I had like a little tent in the HR office, like, what did I do now?
you can't
say the F word when you're, you know, just everything. I that'd probably be a hilarious file to go get from some of my last jobs. Because, like, I've been fired before from TCBY for, like, filling ice cream cones up too full.
Oh, my God.
I mean, oh, yeah. It was a college job. I absolutely refused to weigh the ice cream cone before I would give it to someone. I'm like,
mm-hmm.
Seriously, we're weighing ice cream. Because you had to, they taught you this in training class even. There's a training class that I took to fill ice cream cones hollow with soft serve ice cream and then fill the top up full. And I refused. I'm like, I'm filling the whole cone up, you know, so fire me or whatever. And eventually that's what I got fired for.
And they did.
Yeah, they did. I mean, it's hilarious.
Story.
We'll be in the mall, you know, and my kids will be like, hey, Mom, you should go apply for a job, ha, 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 you know, kind of thing.
And
it's
the moral,
like,
of that story is don't offer up to be fired.
Oh, terrible, yeah. No.
Because,
you know,
they will.
Yeah, no, they will, but I don't think I even said, but
no,
you know,
I
just refused. It's like, seriously? And that was hilarious to me. I'm like, I had so many things going on in my head with, they're filling the ice cream cones up hollow. Do you people know this? You know, I'd had people that would come in and go, she fills the ice cream cones full, go to her, and my line would be longer. And
that's hilarious.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing.
You know, stuff like that, it becomes, I mean, look, and I kind of get that you're talking about, you know, a widget business, you know.
Yeah.
When you are dealing in a business where in entertainment, whether it's music or comedy, whatever it might be, it is a business of opinions. And that is the number one challenge, especially for someone who's a representative, that I believe in my client. And if I'm pitching it to, you know, pitching that person to a network executive or a casting person, if they don't like them, they're like, yeah, I don't like them.
You
what
know,
am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah, that is a really good question. What do you do with that? Do you just have to say, I'm sorry, but, you know.
You try to figure out why they don't like them. If that person still doesn't like what you like, you can't do anything about it when they're the ones who are hiring. You know, when I flipped the fence from being a manager to being on the buying side when I went to work for National Lampoon, of course I put a lot of my old clients into projects I was doing. Of course.
Well, sure.
And I took a lot of heat for that because some people were like, oh, you're just going to give jobs to your old clients. Well, let me put it to you this way. If I was once representing them and trying to get other people to pay them to work, why wouldn't I pay them?
Yeah.
And that was the bottom line to it. It wasn't about, oh, well, just because they used to be my clients. I represented people that I believed in. So
yeah.
I was going to trust their talents to my projects. So I would never put somebody in a role just because they were my client if they were not going to knock it out of the park.
How can you really, I don't know if the word is sell someone, but how can you really pitch someone to do something if you don't even like them?
Right.
I could never do that. I mean, if I was going to represent somebody, I would have to really just genuinely, they'd have to make me laugh or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, because I could never do that if I didn't.
And it comes down to knowing.
Relationship. Yeah.
Well, you know sometimes that you're up against sometimes preconceived ideas. If it's somebody, you know, if it's somebody who's brand new, then it's all about, hey, I've got this new guy, you know, he's really
sure.
And people will be like, sure. But when I started working with Frank, that was a challenge. Because people, oh, I know Frank Stallone. Do you know Frank Stallone?
Yeah, I question that really if people really do. Because
He's brilliant. He's absolutely, totally, and completely brilliant in every way. And I barely know him, but I mean, just from what the little bits and pieces I get, he's brilliant. He's so darn talented in every way, shape, or form. I've looked at some of, you know, because before I put him on the radio show, I was like, okay, I need to get to know him a little bit, too. I need to see some of the work he's done and things like that. Because I generally don't put people on the radio show either unless I like them, because I'm talking to you for an hour and a half, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some of the TV work and the movies he's done, you can put a mustache on him and put him in a Western. He's so versatile.
He gets compared to his brother all the time.
Oh, you know.
Sure, Sly is Sly, you know, and that's great. But Sly can't get on a stage and do a 90-minute music set.
A lot
of actors can't. A lot of actors just, they're actors, and some of them are phenomenal at being actors, and that's fine. And that's great. Comedians have that added dimension of being able to get on a stage and hit people live. Other actors who don't have that background can't do that.
Yeah.
So when talent has that added dimension to them, you have to be able to maximize it.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody like Frank, it's amazing what he can do that a lot of people haven't realized. And I didn't realize it either at first. So, yes, it does come down to you must believe in your talent, because if you don't believe in them, somebody else isn't going to believe in them.
Yeah, absolutely. What a blessed family, though, they have. You know, I think that'd be so neat to just – they're both so unbelievably talented. I mean, I come from in the middle of – I don't know how many kids. There's like 11, 10, 12, something. I don't know how many kids we have. But I'm right smack in the middle. And I can't imagine – I can't even imagine what it would be like if all of us were in the movies or all of us were acting or singing. That's just so cool to have a brother who does movies or a brother that sings or a brother that, you know, I just think it's pretty neat. They're both pretty darn talented and special people.
Yeah, and they've got a great relationship, and it's nice.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, people, I think other people put a chip on Frank's shoulder about it. It's like, give him the chip. But it's like, really, what has your brother done?
Exactly.
You know, his is the biggest
action
star in the world.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
I don't know about your brother, but his is doing okay.
Pretty cool, yeah. So.
His is Rocky and Rambo.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So
what are you going to do?
Not bad. And Frank, you know, is an amazing singer and musician. I mean, the guy has some of the biggest classic songs of all time that you don't even realize that were him.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a competitive figure skater when I was a kid for like 10 years. I skated to his songs.
I used to do gymnastics to one of the songs too. So I get it completely, and I was like, wow, he sings that? I didn't know that. And then but I actually did on one of the songs, cuz I used to say to my parents, I'm like, someday for some reason I know him, the person who sings this song. My parents, it freaked my parents out, and they're like, oh, go, whatever. I'm like, I don't know why, but so pretty funny. I know there's one more bit about you, just a bit of information about you that I think really would help people.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes with divorce. Do we want to end on that, or should we?
Sure. No, I'm happy to.
Do you want to? Okay.
Yeah.
So we just need to keep an eye on time, because I got to get Quinn to swimming. I have a kid who made the swim team, and
that's awesome.
Well, it was kind of cool because we took him over there to get lifeguard license, you know, to get his license to be a lifeguard.
Mm-hmm.
And the new swim coach from Australia just arrived, and he took a look at my kiddo and said, you know, I know you aren't really a competitive swimmer, but can you get in the pool and do a few laps? And apparently my kiddo's a pretty good swimmer.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Fate.
Very nice.
You know? Yeah, but anyway, all right. So let's talk kids for a minute here, because it sounds like you had quite a go of it as a kiddo. I know we both have things like this in our background and everything, but your parents got divorced when you were two, and you actually, tell me about this, there's a landmark child visitation case that makes it so that, like, if parents get divorced, they can't take their kids out of state or something like that. And that's because of
my parents'
case. Your parents, yeah.
Yeah, really. So a custodial parent can't take the children out of state without permission from the other parent, and that stems from my parents' case that was started, I think, back in 74, maybe, 74 or 75. So I grew up in a very tumultuous environment of the court case, And I hadn't seen my father since I was 9 and grew up with my mother and brother. And I haven't spoken to either one of them in, you know, like 20 years ago, I separated myself from that scenario.
Mother, brother, and father, or just mother, brother?
Mother and brother. I hadn't seen my father since I was 9.
You haven't,
so,
okay.
When I got back from school, growing up, there was a lot of trauma. I mean, there was.
Oh yeah.
I think there was too much information handed to us as children, because at the age of 8 and 9, we were being shown like legal documents, and we were being involved in some of the back and forth. But what I didn't know was part of that, and being told all of these things was. It was kind of a manipulation by her,
yeah,
that she wanted us to believe certain things or know certain things. So you, as a kid, you only know what you're told, and you
right.
will believe your parent. So as I got older and things got kind of tumultuous between her and my brother, and she ended up like tossing him out when he was 16 for really no good reason. But I found that there was some stuff that just wasn't setting right, and she was very controlling of my life. And then when I wanted to go away to college, that created a world of problems.
She
because
sounds
of
toxic,
my leaving.
Like toxic.
It was kind of beyond that.
Toxic,
and even
yeah.
that word, like,
it doesn't
never
describe
occurred
it,
to me
does
at the time.
It? Yeah, I was trying to figure
yeah.
out the right word to use for something like that. And
it was
like toxic times whatever, because it sounds.
It was dangerous, I think, because
yeah.
I didn't know. So when I got back from college and there was a lot of problems going on with me and her, my grandfather, who is her father, he's like the only family that I had been connected to, he got very ill and was going to have surgery. And I ended up going back to Chicago where I was born in Chicago, and she moved us to California when I was 6. I had gone back to Chicago.
Hang on 1 second. What was the point of her, if I can ask, and if I ask anything that you don't want to answer, just ask.
Okay.
But what was the point of her going from Chicago to California? Was she trying to get away from him, or was she
yes.
trying to be?
Yeah.
What
no,
was
she
what was in California?
Just a better life, maybe.
Okay.
There was an aunt, I think, that was out here, that she, you know, that we came out and initially saw. But ultimately, she then the thing is that she then filed for no visitation in the state of California,
mm-hmm.
because my brother and I, we didn't want to see our father. It was not
right.
a good scenario.
Was he, yeah.
So he showed up. Because he had an order for visitation from the Illinois court.
Right.
Well, she got an order for no visitation from the California court. There had never been this situation before where there were competing orders. Thus began
a
decade-plus long war of this. I mean, we were splattered on the front page of the Chicago Tribune. There were all these, the lawyers, I mean, I went back and forth for visitation only until I was 9, and then he and I didn't have to go back anymore.
Yeah,
but
people put kids through, it's amazing. It's
yeah, and only when I was 22 and went back to Chicago for my grandfather's surgery, and then he passed away 3 months later, I met some family members that I had never known before, and they started saying stuff to me that didn't make sense about things that happened in the past, and things weren't adding up. I said, I don't understand. That's not what really happened. They were like, no, what you think happened isn't what really happened.
Right.
So all of this started coming out that there was a lot of stuff that I was lied to about as a kid. And certain things started to make sense. Oh, now I understand why that happened with this. And now I understand. And it all started to come to light that I was completely manipulated. I didn't know what was real. I didn't know who was telling the truth, not telling the truth. I had just started working as a receptionist for Bernie Brillstein. My world just, like, fell apart around me. My grandfather passed away. He was the only last connection that I had. And I didn't know what to do. And I walked out from a relationship with my mother. I had seen my brother in Chicago for the first time after 7 years. I had seen him for my grandfather's funeral. That did not go well, so that was over. And I was a mess.
My father, we just don't want to even go.
No, I hadn't seen him since I was 9. But all of these things were coming up that led me to believe that I was lied to about him about a lot of things.
About a lot of things,
so
yeah.
Now I was just in this world of, I didn't know who I really was. And Bernie Brillstein, who was my boss at the time, he literally scraped me up off the ground because I had nothing. It fell apart. I was sleeping on a friend's couch. I lost my entire reason for being. I worshipped my mother growing up, worshipped her. And to find out that she lied to me, and I didn't know what was real, what wasn't.
So was your dad as bad as she made him out to be? Is that sort of what happened?
Not necessarily. I mean, I had my own firsthand impressions of him and ideas of him. But ultimately, I mean, I actually went on like it took 4 years. I actually did a lot of research, pulled court records, documents, did a whole thing so that I could find some peace with myself.
Yeah.
Because Bernie said to me, because I said to him once, I was sitting across the desk from him, and I said, look, my life wasn't supposed to turn out like this. And he said, but it did. So what are you going to do about it?
And
it was a very powerful
thing. That is. I mean, we talk a lot about that on Best Ever You, too. You've got a couple different choices of how to be when you get handed something that you didn't exactly plan for. And sounds like you went the grace and elegance way. Ultimately, maybe through a little bit of anger and stuff there for a while, but
it was not easy. And you know what? Ultimately,
like
if you have cancer, you have to cut it out.
I know.
That's what it comes down to. And just because somebody is your blood family does not mean that you have to be in their lives or that they have to be in yours.
Well, a lot of the time they call that just breaking the cycle of things, you know, where you just want to do something opposite. So how does that stand today? Because
I gave that up. I gave that up a long time ago. I've lived my life on my own. You know, it's like it happened to a different person. I was able to really deal with it and put it away. I'm fine. I mean, ultimately, it's amazing I didn't end up a drug addict troll under a bridge. But
no, I'm divorced and I have two children from a previous marriage. Connor and Quinn are from my first marriage, my 17-year-old and my 15-year-old. But I actually have a really, as divorces go, I have a really amazing, pleasant divorce. Just we're all really good friends and stuff. And I've been divorced for, 15 years. But when I went to go move with my children, in the divorce and things like that, I couldn't move. And I didn't want to move without permission and things like that. We were cordial. You know, there was a custody agreement that said, I'm going to move to California, but here's what I'm going to do, and here's how you're going to see the kids and all stuff. So it was more pleasant than that. But there was something that came up in court, I'm remembering it, that said, he has to give permission in order for you to be able to go. And here's the custody, and here's this, and here's that, and all this stuff. And so we actually had a pleasant go of it, I think, because of that.
Yeah, well, I tell you this. I think parents don't realize sometimes how much their kids are aware of what's going on when they're getting divorced.
Yes.
And for whatever reason people get divorced, it's wrong to think that your process is not felt.
It's
wrong to involve kids too much.
Yeah.
And, you know...
We tried to make it... We were, like, almost overly anally aware of it, like, completely, like, okay, Mike, we need to pay for you to come out here to see the kids. It's been 3 weeks or whatever. You know what I mean? That kind
right.
of thing. Just to keep it as peaceful as possible, because it was clear the marriage wasn't going to work out, but there was no reason to rip kids to shreds in the process.
Yeah.
The kids
are
wonderful, and they're such good kids now. I mean, they're star kids. I mean, they're star baseball, swimmer. Good, get good grades. They do, they're wonderful people.
Right. Well, I think that today, couples who are getting divorced, there's just a bigger awareness about issues like this. Because back when it was happening with me, there wasn't social services, that would just step in at the drop of a hat. There wasn't all of this sensitivity and, all the psychology around the children.
Yeah.
It was nitty gritty and it was raw.
And I go back to my parents' divorce. My father's actually sort of wiped off my birth certificate.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. I'll show you my birth certificate. My birth certificate's almost blank. It says I was born kind of thing and where. And it says my mom's name and my stepdad's name. They wiped my birth father completely off.
and it's a story too long for 10 minutes, but, you know, we went through that kind of a divorce with me where my mom had to hide me because of my dad and things like that. And then my mom married someone with four girls. And there was a whole huge fight over those four girls. So, and this is back in the 70s about this time, too.
Right.
And they got moved out of state and went back and forth between Iowa and Minnesota. And, I mean, they were torn to bits and pieces throughout the process. So very interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, look, when you go, you grow up a certain way, and then you find out that everything you thought was real was not.
Yeah.
It's devastating. And,
oh, absolutely.
You know, I'm lucky that I had
you.
Bernie. He was an amazing figure for me. He gave me a reason to aspire to something. And again, it goes back to what we initially started talking about. If you don't believe in yourself enough, somebody has to. You need somebody in your circle to give you some lift. And he gave me that. Yeah. Not a lot of people know about it. Not a lot of people knew that this is what happened back then. And over the years, he was always there for me. And not a lot of people understood why I was so, you know, in awe of him and why he was such my inspiration. But he was always
my,
I didn't make a move without him. I would sit down with him for advice all the time, and he was phenomenal to me. I think there were times where he would be like, oh, geez, what does she want now? But he still sat with me.
Yeah.
And that's just who he was. He was an amazing person. But
well, I like that, how you keep him alive, too, by talking about him all the time. I think that's pretty special.
I have to. Everything that my thought process goes to what he taught me over the years and what he inspired me to do. And he's got a great book out. It's called, David Renson wrote it, and it's called You're No One in Hollywood Unless Someone Wants You Dead, Where Did I Go Right? And then he has another one called It's All Lies and That's the Truth. But David Renson is a phenomenal biographer, and it's a hugely inspirational book for anybody. I use it as like a little Bible. But it's
Say the name of it again. So you're not.
The little Bible one is It's All Lies and That's the Truth.
Okay.
And the other book is You're No One in Hollywood Unless Someone Wants You Dead, Where Did I Go Right?
Huh.
They're both written by Bernie and David Renson. But, you know, it's like when you – I got lucky that I had him to inspire me, but it was brutal finding out that the one person that you were supposed to rely on and trust was not who you thought or what you thought. So it was a big decision to – terminate those relationships and move on. And I did. And other people that I encounter sometimes have a harder time with it than I do, especially
It's hard to hear because, you know, a lot of me wants to go, well, someday maybe you'll repair that, you know, kind of thing. And I'm just like, I'm not going there, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean,
you always want to see the best, and you always want to see people, you know, try and mend their ways and get along and things like that. And, you know, maybe
sometimes you can't.
Knows. Yeah, and
you know, I watch
but sometimes you're right there. Sometimes you really just flat out can't, and you're better off for it.
Yeah, I watch some of these talk shows where they have grown children of divorce, adult children of divorce speak out, and they have these psychologists on or these advisors who have never been through a divorce. Their parents are still married, or they don't know the first thing. And sometimes I get really irritated that some of the advice is so you have to try this.
No, you don't.
Sometimes
what you
have to do is move on.
Yep.
Move on, deal with it, because if you don't deal with it fully, it will creep out of your brain.
And it'll eat you alive, yeah.
Yes. Yes. It's like, for me now, it's like it happened to another person.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with it. And, you know, I move forward and throw myself into my career.
Yeah. Which is awesome, by the way.
Well,
it's quite a career, and we are... we're really proud of you, and I have to go to swimming with my quinny
quinn. Thank you for having me on the talk.
What an amazing inspiration. And,
completely. Thank you so much for having me. I hope that maybe it helps somebody out there.
Oh, I think it will. I mean, we've talked about everything from, you know, how, you know, your career from the very beginning to how you're doing today. And is there anything you want to end with? Maybe something about Frank Stallone, go back to him for a minute, and about his website or anything new. I know there's a November 17th.
Anyone who's in the L.A. area this weekend should come see him perform at the Mint on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. He's doing a great acoustic set. Visit frankstallone.com to see what he's up to.
Yeah. And well, we feel blessed to know both of you. I know our network and our audience really appreciates both of you for being on the show. I know he's going to be on our magazine cover, and you wrote a really incredible article about him that we're just really excited for that to come out. That should be out here at the end of December or so. So,
thanks.
So November. So this, what did you say, this Saturday, the 17th?
This Saturday the 17th at the Mint in Los Angeles.
Oh, that's neat. Will he be doing, I got to go too. I know I keep talking. It's like, will he be doing anything around the country at some point? Because we got a few emails like that. Like, how can I see him in my state or in my city?
If somebody is in a town that they would love to see him come to, absolutely. You know, go to your local club and say, hey, bring Frank Stallone here. So, would love that. Absolutely.
And then he's done a couple new songs, Carry On, and then he did the one for Expendables 2. What's happening with that?
Yeah, Don't Wanna Fight With Me.
Yeah.
You know, we're actually hoping, with fingers crossed, that it gets nominated for a Grammy.
Oh, that'd
be neat. Nomination period is done for that it's a whole process through the Grammy organization.
Yeah.
But December 5th, I believe, is when they announce who gets nominated. If it happens, it would be phenomenal. He was last nominated for a Grammy 30 years ago.
Wow.
30 years ago for Staying Alive, the soundtrack. So it would be really terrific. But he's performing on New Year's Eve at Vitello's in Studio City out here in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of choices what to do, and he said, you know what, I want to stay local, I want to go to a club that's like my home club and spend it with people I love. So anyone in Los Angeles for New Year's Eve, if you want to come see Frank at Vitello's, that's going to be a party.
What's the name of it again?
Vitello's. It's more known out here, but
it's a great spot.
It's the classic Italian dinner place, dinner supper club. So
fun,
it's going to be a fun night for that. And, hopefully we'll be getting him out there a lot more. And he just did a movie with John Herzfeld, which is very exciting. John had 2 Days in the Valley was John's movie. So he's got a new movie that Frank just did. And hopefully things are really building for him. And, you know, look, it's interesting to come back into a career that I left a decade ago, because at the time I said, in 10 years, I still don't want to be doing this.
Well, you know, I honestly think there's a reason, and I think you'll know that looking back, because it just seems like you guys are supposed to do stuff together. It just really does. It seems like he needs you, you need him. I don't know, but there's something cool that's going to happen with both of you guys. You can just feel it.
Right.
I don't know what it is, but whatever.
I hope you're right. I
heard
it here
first. No, I'm just kidding.
You heard it here first.
Oh, boy. Okay, I'm off to swimming, but thank you. Lots of love.
Thanks for listening to the Best Ever You Show. Want more? Visit us at besteveryou.com. Be your best and keep it real. Confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You.